So good afternoon, everyone, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to spend my time this afternoon talking about gun violence and mental illness from a public health perspective, how we think about policies and laws to reduce the risk of gun violence in relation to mental illness and mental health in the population, and how we might bring public health law research evidence to bear on that problem and on that process, and I have no relationships to disclose. So it has been almost a year now since all of us were absorbing the truly terrible news of the school children massacred by a troubled young man at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. And in the months and that have passed since that horrible day, I think all of us have wanted to do something, just pass a law, have a new policy, do something to try to prevent this sort of event from happening again. And one of the things I think that has happened is that in the public conversations and the private conversations that we've had, we have, I think, expanded the frame of this to be more than just about mass shootings, but really about the epidemic of gun violence in America, to use that occasion to think about this problem. And it is truly a massive problem. 32,000 people lose their lives as a result of a gunshot every year, 74,000 injured. It's a big problem. It's a complicated problem. Sometimes it's overwhelming. And what I'd like to suggest that we do today is to just clear a little bit of white space, to think about it, and to deconstruct the problem, to strip it down to its bare ingredients, and then work backwards from there to think about how laws and policies might help us reduce this problem, particularly in relation to mental health. So if you think about it in the simplest terms, the ingredients are these. We need two things. We need dangerous people and guns. And they have to happen together. They potentiate each other. And, you know, in theory, we could do what many countries do and broadly limit legal access to guns. And in a world like that, you could, in theory, have lots of dangerous people, people still inclined to hurt each other and do harmful things. But if they didn't have access to a firearm, what they would do would be far less lethal, far less deadly. And countries that do this tend to have far lower homicide rates than we do. We could also, in theory, live in a world with far fewer dangerous people if we attack the root causes of violence. And in theory, in a world like that, you could have lots of guns and you still wouldn't have gun violence. But they have to happen together. And I think that's helpful to think about that juxtaposition as we reimagine policies and how they might work. So there are lots of laws and policies that are really about the guns. You know, we have the Second Amendment to the Constitution, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says that we can't ban certain categories of guns, assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines, laws that require safe storage of guns. We could, you know, think about personalized gun technology that could be applied so that a gun would only work literally in the hands of its rightful permitted owner. But, you know, if you did all those things, you would still have the dangerous people problem. You would still have people who could use a gun that's been safely stored and legally acquired to commit mayhem and a harmful act. So we have laws and policies that are really designed to put up a barrier between a person who's dangerous, who might be harmful, and a lethal weapon. And so again, there's nothing in the Constitution that says we can't prohibit firearms from people who've committed a felony, people with a history of mental health adjudication. We can have background checks, we can have waiting periods for people who wanted to buy a gun, and we could remove guns from people when they're dangerous. Some states actually do that. And so, you know, if we did those things, that sounds good, but we still have a problem. Because guess what? We don't always know who the dangerous people are. Psychiatrists are notoriously bad at predicting in advance which of their patients might do something harmful. I mean, it's great if you have a retrospectoscope and you go backwards, but looking forward, it's hard to do that. So what if we thought about laws and policies to address the root causes of violence, get upstream, try to, you know, invest in things that make for healthy communities and fewer kids exposed to terrible trauma who grow up to be perpetrators? You know, the social safety net, education, affordable housing, jobs, you know, try to do something along those lines. Treat violence as if it were a disease, you know, from a public health perspective. And invest in better access to substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment for people who need that. And, you know, if we did all of those things, I mean, it's not a one, two, or three thing problem, and it's not a one, two, or three thing solution. If you did all these things, we might chip away at the problem through different avenues, different means. There is the determinants. If we did things to have less poverty, substance abuse, untreated psychopathology in the community, we might have less violence. There's deterrence for people who are going to do something harmful, put up that barrier and limit their means of getting a weapon. And then there's just dangerousness, something to do to make the guns less lethal. Well, do gun laws work? I mean, in general, you know, you can take the Brady campaign scorecard of states that measures the restrictiveness of state gun laws across a whole bunch of categories on a 0 to 100 scale. And if you correlate that with the CDC's fatality statistics, you find that there's a negative correlation. But it only holds up, really, in the states that have a relatively low saturation of firearms. If you look over there on the left, those are states with fewer than 35% of the households with guns, and there you see this negative correlation. More gun law restrictiveness, less fatality. As you move to states that have between 35 and 50% of the households with guns, it's a weaker correlation. And in the states with over 50% of the households with guns, you know, either the laws don't work or we can't tell, because there just aren't any states that have a lot of regulation and a lot of guns. States that have a lot of guns tend to have liberal gun laws. Well, so there's mental health. You know, this is, I think, emerging as the one square inch of common real estate between the people who are concerned about civil rights and gun rights and people who are concerned about regulating firearms from a public safety perspective. So, is this the answer? Some people think that what we need to do is just put more and more and more gun-disqualifying mental health records into the National Instant Check System so that when people go to buy a gun from a licensed dealer, if they have a history of a disqualifying mental health condition, they won't be able to do that. And as you can see, along the lines of those benchmarks of mass shootings on the x-axis, you know, the number of these records in the NICS has just expanded almost exponentially. There's now more than 3 million in there. Meanwhile, 99% of those records have not resulted in a denial of a firearm. So, you know, it's hard, and there are lots of reasons I could give you if I had more time, why background checks, as currently implemented, aren't going to work very well. They could be improved. But as it stands, it's hard to see if it's working how it is. Here's the results of a research project that our group published earlier this year, and I'm showing you two trend lines here. And the data points are the risk of violent crime month by month by month over 2002 to 2009. The red line there are people with a history of mental health adjudication that disqualifies them from buying a gun. And the blue line are their counterparts who have voluntary admission history with serious mental illness, but they don't have a disqualifying condition or adjudication. And you see that the red line is higher risk over those early years. And then in 2007, what happens? Connecticut deposits a whole bunch of records into the National Instant Check System. And you can see that. You look, you might say, well, that works. That's a good thing. Except that it only applies to 7% of the seriously mentally ill population in the public system. And 95% of the crimes in this study population were committed by people who were not exposed to this policy, not disqualified. So it might have an effect kind of on the margins, but it's not going to be, you know, the answer to this problem, even with respect to mental health. Let's think about some policy approaches that states are thinking about. Some have enacted. One is expanded gun disqualification. Let's just expand the categories of people who shouldn't be able to buy a gun. In Pennsylvania, for example, earlier this year, Pennsylvania deposited about 600,000 new records of people who had come in under an emergency psychiatric petition, an emergency hospitalization that didn't necessarily result in a full commitment. But, you know, and there was a discussion about whether those would be disqualifying under federal law. That's one solution to think about this. Connecticut now disqualifies people who have a voluntary psychiatric hospitalization. In California, people with a history of a violent misdemeanor, you know, a misdemeanor assault charge are disqualified. Then there's the idea of dangerous person's gun seizure. Let's not wait and try to intercept someone who wants to buy a new gun when they might already have 5 or 6 or 10 at home. Why don't we figure out how to remove guns from people at the time when they're dangerous? And there are two versions of that law in Indiana and Connecticut. And in California, there are people who come into the emergency commitment system who are disqualified. Then there is the idea of just increasing screening, surveillance, treatment. Why not get the mental health professionals involved, clinicians, if they have a patient or a client who indicates that they might do something harmful, have them report that to the police. That's very controversial in terms of, you know, what it might do to undermine the confidentiality of doctor-patient relationships and inhibit people's disclosures and so on. Threat assessment teams on college campuses. These are mandated now in Virginia and all college campuses. And there's the idea, well, think about people with serious mental illness who either can't or don't or won't comply with recommended psychiatric treatment. What about mandating treatment? Outpatient commitment is also a controversial policy. It was part of the expansions in the New York SAFE Act that was enacted earlier this year. And then there's the idea of just investing in the public mental health system infrastructure, prevent the unpredicted. We can't find the needle in the haystack. Let's treat the whole haystack. Where's the evidence for this? Well, you know, it turns out that we need to do a lot more research. You know, I mean, some of these things are valid on their face. They sound good. But when you try to look at where the evidence is for the effectiveness of these policies and the absence of harm, you know, it's clear that we need to do more research. There's research on violent misdemeanors, reducing violent crime, gun crime in California. There's a database, a literature on outpatient commitment. Ironically, the one thing we have good evidence for is the one thing people say is too hard to do, which is to attack the community-based social determinants, the root causes of violence. One piece of research here, these are risks of violence in people with serious mental illness by exposure to other risk factors. The three here you see are substance abuse, history of violent victimization, and living in a neighborhood where you're exposed to violence all the time. People that don't have those other risk factors, very, very low risk of violence. People who have all three of them, far increased risk of violence. So I don't know what to do, but I think there are several principles that should guide our reforms going forward. We should prioritize contemporaneous risk assessment, not just disqualify vast categories of people. We need to do something to preempt existing gun access instead of just thwarting a new gun purchase from someone who might have, you know, six guns at home. We need to remember there's a constitutional right at stake here. So we need to provide due process under the Constitution, not just some legal authority that comes out of nowhere, and preserve confidential therapeutic relationships. That's the bedrock of doctor-patient relationships. It's really important, and it can have terribly adverse consequences if it's undermined. And finally, there's something to be said for preventing the unpredicted. And I think if we did all these things, if we used these kinds of principles, we would find our way to policies that would reduce gun violence, and I think we would live in a far less violent society. Thank you.